whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. Early voting is now underway in Detroit. Both presidential candidates have been campaigning hard in the battleground state of Michigan, where CBS's Nancy Cordes reports it's a toss-up right now.
A Harris campaign memo, first obtained by CBS News, argues her path to win Michigan capitalizes on Trump's unprecedented weakness in the suburbs, which she narrowly won in 2020. But then came the rollback of Roe v. Wade, which even he seemed to acknowledge has hurt him with suburban women.
You have one issue. You have the issue of abortion. Without abortion, the women love me.
Harris will do an event in Detroit this afternoon before heading to Atlanta. Trump is holding a rally tonight in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Almost 2,000 documents were released in the election interference case of former President Trump. CBS's Scott McFarlane on what some of them tell us about what he allegedly did when he was told there was a riot happening at the Capitol.
Jack Smith has argued Trump scrolled his phone and watched the attack on TV that day without immediately calling off the rioters. Trump tried to delay the release of these passages until after the election, but Judge Chutkan ruled holding back the information itself from the public would be election interference.
The number of people dying from overdosing has dropped. Here's CBS's Michael Toscano.
Preliminary numbers from the CDC say drug overdose deaths fell 12.7% in the 12 months ending in May. While welcome, the drop is puzzling to the public health experts who have been working for years to stop the increase in opioid deaths driven primarily by fentanyl.
Our Allison Keyes reports on a huge increase in migrant deaths near the border.
At the faith-based Hope Border Institute in El Paso, Executive Director Dylan Corbett ticks off the reasons for the increase in migrant deaths, from climate change to cruel smugglers driving people into the blazing desert, tight border enforcement in Texas, and the Biden administration's latest asylum restrictions.
The only way that we're going to fix this is real meaningful reforms. The deaths are an index of that broken system.
The former U.S. Marine who was wrongfully detained in Russia for nearly 6 years is speaking out for the first time since he was freed in a prisoner swap in August. Paul Whelan told CBS's Margaret Brennan about a phone call he had with President Biden.
He basically tells me that Brittany Griner was going home, that the trade was for Victor Boot. And, you know, I asked him point blank. I said, so what else do you have to trade? And he said, nothing. I said, you gave up your negotiation platform. There's nothing else. How do you now get me back?
There is much more to that interview. You can watch the full one tomorrow on Face the Nation. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The candidates for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin have starkly different views on reproductive rights. Democratic incumbent Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Eric Hovde debated Friday night. Hovde says Wisconsin and all 50 states should decide for themselves.
I think we as a state should resolve this issue with a referendum where everybody gets a right to vote. The voters get a right to vote, I get the right to vote.
Baldwin says the better way is to codify Roe v. Wade nationwide.
Your rights and freedoms should not depend on your zip code or the state in which you live.
The race has tightened, and the outcome in Wisconsin could determine the balance of power in the entire U.S. Senate. Senator Baldwin has accused Eric Hovde of saying single parenthood leads to poverty and drug addiction. Here's Tricia Young with a Wisconsin Watch fact check.
Hovde, who was running against Tammy Baldwin, was criticized in a Baldwin ad for allegedly suggesting single motherhood leads to household poverty or drug addiction. Hovde said children, quote, born out of wedlock, unquote, face a, quote, direct path to poverty, unquote, citing studies linking single-parent households to higher drug rates. Studies support this correlation, particularly among low-income households. I'm Tricia Young for Wisconsin Watch. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, a high near 72, and a south wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 53 degrees. Sunshine for Sunday and nice with highs in the low 80s. For Monday, mostly sunny and a high near 80.
Right now, it's 55.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll have a guest from Planned Parenthood on how the fight to restore women's health care rights is not losing steam as Election Day draws near.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. This is 93.5 The Tap. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, I am your host for this hour, also next hour, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is Amicus, a law review. I am honored. I am delighted to have you joining me for whatever your calendar today permits. This hour and next hour, lots and lots of things pulled right from the current events news of these past days and weeks. We're going to spend some time talking with you, engaging with you in some of that discussion about those major issues in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice here in the state of Wisconsin, beyond, throughout the United States of America, across our planet as well. Lots and lots of things to talk about on this, our weekly weekend venued broadcast. As you know well, we take our name Amicus from the Latin, also a legal term meaning friend, an individual, an organization that somehow assists in understanding or appreciation, some assessment of some controversial or non-controversial issue that needs to be decided, needs to be resolved in some way by a court, a judge, some governmental entity, maybe some private party as well, some private institution looking for some decision-making authority, some perspective, some insight. And it is in that modest commission that we take our view, our perspective on conducting a review, an analysis, some deliberation offered to you, some consideration of those recent news items for greater understanding and appreciation of the world in which we live. That includes the state of Wisconsin. That includes our great nation, the United States of America. And yes, indeed, it includes the planet on which we are all citizens of humanity. With this weekend, lots and lots of issues, lots and lots of topics on our syllabus, our ambitious but achievable agenda for this weekend broadcast. And as always, my terrific producer, Sam, and I are going to be soliciting and taking your phone calls at this number, 608-610-1126, 608-610-1126. Sam and I are here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media, right here in downtown Madison, broadcasting just off of the UW-Wisconsin campus, just in the shadow of our spectacular Madison Capitol Dome, a farmer's market going around on Capitol Square this morning. Delightful to be here in Madison for our weekly broadcast, talking with you, engaging with you on all of these important issues. Let me give you some sense of what is going to animate that syllabus, that academic schedule in the coming hours. We're going to spend a good deal of time, as we have in the past, talking with you, bringing you some updates from just this past week about some of these major stories. And yes, once again, those major four criminal cases pending against a present candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. You know his name. It is Donald Trump. And right now he is a defendant. In one case, convicted defendant. In other cases, an unconvicted defendant, presumed to be innocent until, if ever, a jury finds him guilty of the offense conduct in those other three cases. We're going to talk about those four cases, in particular, things that happened just this past week in that major federal election interference case, the insurrection-related case that's pending right now in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. She is the federal district court judge in the District of Columbia. She did something very significant just this past Friday. She released more information in this pre-trial period. We're going to talk about exactly what her decision was, why she made that decision well in advance of a trial that is not yet even scheduled, to disclose to the public, into the public domain, some materials now in the docket of that case. Donald Trump there charged in four different counts by a federal grand jury there in the District of Columbia. Judge Chutkan now has this responsibility for figuring out what to do with respect to the administration of that case, handling the trial whenever she schedules that, probably for some time well into next year, if not beyond. We'll talk about exactly what she did, what documents she released into the public domain as a part of her continuing administration and oversight of that case just this past week, and how it implicates the future, not just of that case, but other issues. The timing of this, obviously, right before our national election. In addition to that, some news coming out of New York, and in particular, that hush money case in which Donald Trump, the defendant there, was previously convicted of violations of New York state law, having to do with false statements, false representations, false documents that he put together in connection with those payments to Stormy Daniels through his attorney, his so-called fixer, Michael Cohen. We'll talk about what happened in that case just this past week involving yet another petition, another application to the federal court seeking to have the proceedings there in state court removed to the federal court. We'll talk about the merits, the demerits, candidly, of that continuing petition advanced by Donald Trump and also by his counsel. Every right to do that. That's aggressive. That's appropriate advocacy on behalf of their client. We'll talk about what's going on in an appeals court in New York with respect to that hush money case scheduled for sentencing sometime long after the election coming up here in just a couple of weeks. We're also then going to go south. We're going to go to Georgia. That other state case, that other case involving election interference in which a state grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, charged Donald Trump and many other people, many other defendants in that case, likewise with violation of Georgia state law for attempting to undermine, to overthrow the results of the election, the 2020 election results there in Georgia. We'll talk about what happened just this past week as the prosecutor there, you know her name as well, that's Fannie Willis. What did Fannie Willis do just this past week in connection with her continuing pursuit of that prosecution? Also at an appeals court, what did she do just this past week with respect to six counts of that pending indictment against Donald Trump and against many other individuals there in Georgia? And finally, yes, indeed, there is some news coming out of Mar-a-Lago as well, in particular, that related federal case also being prosecuted by the special counsel. It is federal. It's being prosecuted by Jack Smith. That is the case that is pending right now in southern Florida, a federal district court there. Her name is Eileen Cannon. She is the judge who's presiding over that federal matter. Some information just this past week about the continuing work of the prosecutors there. Some decisions made by the prosecutors in that case, anticipating that it's going to be a long time, as it is in these three other cases, before that case sees a trial date, before anybody, including Eileen Cannon, can schedule that matter on for trial. We'll talk about some major rule of law and administrative news that came out of South Florida just this past week, all as a part of our review of the pendency of those cases as we head in to the national election in just a few days. Necessarily, along the way, we're going to spend some time talking about the job that Tanya Chutkan has now been given, the assignment given to her by the United States Supreme Court to try to figure out what she's going to do in connection with that trial. We'll talk about the analysis that she will necessarily have to undertake and pursue to try to apply what the Supreme Court did on July 1, finding for the first time in 238 years of our national history that indeed our presidents, our chief executives, do enjoy some immunities for what? for criminal acts that they may commit in the White House. It is stunning to say that out loud. I hope that it strikes you as stunning as well. That's what the Supreme Court said. And we will spend some time in connection with the case pending right now in front of Tanya Chutkan talking about exactly what kind of analysis she will now need to undertake as she considers the merits and the demerits of the positions presented to her appropriately as a part of a routine procedure by both the prosecution and by the defense in that case, as she figures out what's next. What is next on the docket? What does she have to do to determine whether or not that case can go to trial at all in the wake of the Supreme Court decision? And if so, what about the pending charges against Donald Trump? There's still four in number. They're a part of a superseding indictment, a new indictment returned by a grand jury there not too long ago. She's got to figure out, okay, what is it the Supreme Court has told all of us about immunities, and how do I, as the federal district court judge, apply those to this new charging document? That's her assignment. I'm going to talk a little bit about the analysis that she will probably need to undertake as she undertakes that very significant role in on behalf of the people of America, certainly on behalf of justice generally in our great nation. Then, as a part of our continuing review of things, anticipating what may or may not happen on November 5th in America, we're going to talk about this issue of the Department of Justice and try to figure out, in our broadcast this weekend, what kinds of things are indeed available to Donald Trump if he becomes the next president of the United States of America? What kinds of things can he and can he not do when it comes to using the Department of Justice, for example, to jail his rivals, as he was promised to do other things that may arguably affect the administration of justice in America? What kinds of things, knowing the structure, the administration of the Justice Department, what can he realistically do? What can he not do as a part of our constitutional system? We'll spend some time talking about that. And finally, well into our second hour on our weekend broadcast, we're going to spend some time talking once again about the United States Supreme Court, which had five more oral arguments just this past week. We're going to talk about three of them having to do with everything from medical marijuana, having to do with things related to visas and immigration issues, and also having to do with water pollution, a case coming out of San Francisco. Some very interesting cases there in all of those areas undertaken by our United States Supreme Court just in this past week. Oral arguments, of course, this opportunity for the attorneys representing the parties in those cases to talk with the justices, as they often do, to receive their questions, to respond to their questions, to provide them with some information, some insight orally about why it is they think that their position should be the one the Supreme Court embraces. That's what oral argument is all about. I'm going to talk about in these areas of marijuana and visas and immigration and EPA and environmental issues, what the Supreme Court addressed just this past week. And so as we go forward here, we're going to be talking about all those things. We invite, as always, your phone calls at 608-610-1126. Here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, delighted to have you with me and Sam as we talk about all of these matters and more here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio.
The Dom Salvia Show.
And I heard the scientists say the other day that when a man votes for a woman, he actually transitions into a woman.
What yes, happens what? When a woman votes for a man?
Turns into a man.
But that's okay, though.
That's fine.
Yeah, because then she gets control of her body.
Oh.
I see what I did there?
Yeah.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host this hour and next hour. I'm joined here in the wonderful broadcast studios of Civic Media by my terrific producer, Sam. And together we are taking your questions, your inquiries about our ambitious but achievable agenda, our discussion of all things related to courts and justice and the administration of the rule of law in America. We're going to be spending some time principally in this, the first hour of our weekend broadcast, doing a bit of a review of those four major cases pending with respect to Donald Trump right now in our federal and state courts in a number of different venues. We're going to begin with the District of Columbia, and that once again is where Donald Trump, for a long period of time, well over a year now, has been charged by a federal grand jury, this group of 26 people brought in there to determine whether there's probable cause to believe that there is a reason to go ahead with charges. An indictment initially returned by Donald Trump to Donald Trump and to America, charging him with four different violations of federal law. Superseding indictment returned very recently. A new indictment. That's what superseding means. Basically, responding to what the Supreme Court did on July 1, finding for the first time catastrophically, remarkably, dramatically in our nation's history that a chief executive, one of our presidents, is immune from criminal prosecution for those things that he or one day she might do in the White House. In the wake of that, a grand jury again in the District of Columbia returned a new indictment, basically doing two principal things. And it's significant because it's going to animate and describe what Tanya Chutkan has in front of her as she goes forward and wrestles with what to do next. The first thing that that new indictment did was it stripped away all references, at least charged references, to communications, engagements between Donald Trump and the United States Department of Justice, an important topic that we're going to get to later on in this, our weekend broadcast. And the reason why that indictment did that is because the Supreme Court said that with respect to engagements and communications between a president and his or her attorney general, the Department of Justice generally, that again is supposed to be, if not completely independent, quite independent of the oversight, the political involvement, the partisan perspectives of a White House. That's the tradition of America. The Supreme Court saying that with respect to any communications and engagements between the White House, the Oval Office, and the Attorney General and his or her staff there in Washington, around the country, involving United States attorneys as well, absolute immunity, a president completely immune. The kinds of things that Richard Nixon did back in 1972 and 1973 to obstruct justice now basically authorized by the Supreme Court because of this immunity grant given to presidents with respect to engagements with the United States Department of Justice. Well, what did the new grand jury do? It stripped away all of those so-called charges that were previously there, the narratives that support that notion. And so it basically conformed to what the Supreme Court said, can't prosecute for those kinds of things. So those are gone. Those are no longer a part of the indictment. The other significant thing that Jack Smith did with respect to the grand jury and this new superseding indictment was to emphasize a very important point, which gets us into our discussion this weekend. And that is the personal, private nature of everything that's left. That this was not done in an official capacity. This was not a part of a president's, in particular, Donald Trump's execution of his assigned responsibilities under the Constitution. These were personal, private activities and events intended for one purpose, to remain in power. And that those are not official acts. Those are the private, personal acts of a president who is attempting to remain in power in violation of federal law. We're going to talk about exactly what that means for Tanya Chutkan and for Donald Trump in just a few moments. So what did she do? What did Tanya Chutkan do just this past week in connection with the continuing oversight of hers of this case? Well, you may recall as well, we talked about this on this broadcast, that Tanya Chutkan, a number of weeks ago, called all the attorneys in and said, tell me what you think I should do in the wake of this Supreme Court decision that seemingly has a huge impact upon the capacity of all of us to try this case. And of course, defense counsel said, the answer is you need to dismiss it, Tanya Chutkan. You need to get rid of this case entirely. The Supreme Court has said immunities, whether they are absolute or presumptive, which we'll get to as well, presumptive immunities keep the prosecution from going ahead at all. Jack Smith says absolutely not. He has filed a 165-page memorandum in which he's described not only the basis for going ahead, but the reasons why. The reasons why that decision by the United States Supreme Court does not compel a dismissal of any further portion of this new indictment. And that's what his document, his narrative document said of a couple of weeks ago. We spent a lot of time talking about some of the revelations in that narrative document submitted routinely. This is not atypical. This is not something that's out of the ordinary. Judges all the time solicit and receive pretrial pleadings and statements of likely evidence to be presented in a case. Admittedly, this one in the national and international eye, but nonetheless, a part of a routine process here. And she has also afforded the defense sometime after Thanksgiving to submit their own document about what they think should happen in this case, even-handed administration of justice. And so we've seen Jack Smith's very long opus about the reasons why this case should be scheduled for trial, why the Supreme Court case on immunity does not prevent the further prosecution of the remaining aspects of this new indictment. That's pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. In addition, at the time, he also filed about 1,800 pages of supporting material, all kinds of things out there. And that is what? That is what Tanya Chutkan just this past week also now released into the public domain. Lots of it. Lots of it is what we know. Lots of it is what we have seen in the narrative and what we know from reporting. But some of it, as we're going to discuss, is somewhat new and provides some additional gloss on this notion that these were private and personal activities and that nothing about the immunities prevent the case from going ahead in the near future. That's what she released. She released it. She released it over the strong objection of Donald Trump. It is still redacted. Major portions of it are not accessible at all to any of us to see. But those portions that are, again, give us some additional insight into what the trial of this case may look like over Donald Trump's strong, strong objection. The materials, again, they're in a four-part appendix to this lengthy brief that was previously filed, consisting altogether of 1,889 pages, most of that redacted, and can be seen only by the parties to this particular case. And of course, all of this done after the judge herself has made some decisions about whether it's appropriate to release all this into the public domain. All of it, obviously, eventually going to become a part of the public domain. We know that federal criminal trials, like most state trials as well, all of those are public proceedings with some very narrow exceptions that are extraordinary. And so what did Judge Chutkan do in an opinion late Thursday of this past week? She rejected the objection of the Trump team, and she said that consistent with her position that she's going to pay no attention to Donald Trump's campaign schedule, the fact that indeed this is a matter that's going ahead while he's campaigning for the presidency. And she argued that withholding this material from the public that otherwise has a right to see it would in fact violate some fundamental notions about our public attention to trials. And all of that in an order issued on Thursday. Following that, of course, she released the documents on Friday. As we continue with our discussion here, we're going to talk more about exactly what she did and hear from her directly, her own words about the reasons why she did that. We'll continue with this discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matinee on Air.
CBS News Brief. With 17 days until Election Day, voters are out in full force showing support for their candidate. These people were at a rally for Vice President Harris in Michigan.
I have a phone bank. There are a group of people that I have to call.
Mailing phone calls, brochures in my neighborhood, 350 this past 2 weeks.
All right.
Drug overdose deaths are down. While good news, CBS's Michael Descano tells us health officials are puzzled.
Overdose reduction strategies like the increased availability of Narcan, the rescue medication that can reverse opioid overdoses, were in use long before the abrupt decrease.
Paul Whelan told CBS's Face the Nation about the phone call he had with the White House after a prisoner swap got Brittany Griner out of Russia, but not him.
I said point blank to him, you realize what you've done, that you've abandoned me here.
CBS News Brief. I'm Stacy Lynn.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
It's the Packers and the Texans. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers host the Houston Texans, kickoff tomorrow at noon. I asked Packers quarterback Jordan Love about facing Houston's defensive line, led by Will Anderson and former Viking Danielle Hunter.
Yeah, no, they are definitely a very good defense. I think all around, you know, they got very good players everywhere. So I think it all starts up front. They got a really good D-line, some good edge rushers, and coverages, everything. I mean, in the back end is very good. Their DBs are good. Linebackers are good. So I think they're a solid team all around.
Love, of course, waited 3 years to play behind Aaron Rodgers. Texans quarterback C.J. Stroud was able to start his rookie year.
I feel like maybe for Jordan, he wanted him to see the field and, you know, learn from Aaron and, you know, being able to just be a sponge and, you know, suck up just a lot of information. You know, I think it's just a testament to whoever's watching, like, who's trying to get to our positions. Is like, no matter what route you're in, or, like, you know, have to sit and wait a little bit. Like, my dad used to always tell me, cream rises to the top.
That's Texans quarterback C.J. Stroud. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, a high near 72, and a south wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 53 degrees. Sunshine for Sunday and nice with highs in the low 80s. For Monday, mostly sunny and a high near 80.
Right now, it's 55.
This is an important announcement for Wisconsinites who plan to vote in the November 2024 election. Leading nonpartisan economists have analyzed the economic plans of Donald Trump and concluded that he would cause inflation to rise and the economy to slow. And 16 Nobel Prize-winning economists wrote a letter warning that Donald Trump would reignite inflation with his fiscally irresponsible budgets. Donald Trump's tariff plan would act as a national sales tax, costing the average family as much as $4,000 per year. But Vice President Kamala Harris's plan would help middle-class families deal with rising costs. In her first 100 days, Kamala Harris would pass a ban on price gouging at the grocery store. And as vice president, she worked to cap the cost of many prescription drugs, including insulin, saving many families thousands of dollars per year. On the economy, the choice is clear. Vote Kamala Harris for president. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Action, www.abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Have you outgrown your health insurance plan? The number one reason we all change our health insurance is price. Are you paying too much for your health insurance? Would you like to have better coverage at a better rate? Take a few minutes right now and find out if you can save money or even qualify for zero-cost health insurance in your state. Call now.
800-693-9308. 800-693-9308. That's 800-693-9308.
The Todd Alba Show.
Minority Rule. The author is Ari Berman.
If you look back at Wisconsin history, it gave rise to Social Security and unemployment insurance and collective bargaining. It really personified the idea that no matter what political party you were with, government should work for the common good. And Walker had a very different idea, that government should work for this conservative elite instead.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Maggie Dawn.
Next, I've got Michael Sozan, Senior Fellow for Democracy Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We're going to discuss Trump's attacks on democracy. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
¶¶
is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are doing one of our regular reviews of those major cases, those criminal cases pending against Donald Trump right now, updating you on things that have happened just this past week, including this major decision by Judge Tanya Chutkan in the United States District Court in the District of Columbia to release this trove, this 1,800-page set of documents in four different volumes of all the materials that Jack Smith has submitted, indicating, arguing to Tanya Chutkan that all of this should be a part of a trial. None of this needs to be excluded. All of this a part of a trial of Donald Trump yet to be scheduled in the wake of that Supreme Court case finding with respect to some aspects of a presidential set of activities and events. A president can, in fact, be immune from prosecution. Jack Smith says no with respect to at least these charges. And so what do we know? What do we know about why Tanya Chutkan did what she did? Again, a part of a routine process here in the public domain, filing these things initially under seal and then making the determination, as she has, that the public needs to know. And she said this. She said, if the court withheld this information, again, these are these large numbers of documents, that the public otherwise had a right to access solely because of the potential political consequences of releasing it. She's plainly talking about the pendency of the campaign and the forthcoming election. If the court withheld that information, she said, from the public, you've got a right to access to it, she says, just because of the potential political consequences of releasing it, that withholding could itself constitute or appear to be election interference. In other words, if she withholds these things, she herself is engaging in exactly what Donald Trump's attorneys are accusing her of doing by releasing this. They maintained, in opposition to her doing any of this, that by her doing this right now in days, weeks before the election, that she is interfering with the election. She says, nope, just the opposite. You've got this turned on its head, that by failing to do so, we'd be interfering with the election. And so she releases virtually all of these documents. And I say virtually because of the four volumes, these 1,800, almost 1,900 pages of material, great portions of it are redacted. We do not know. And so that is in the public domain, but still a lot to be revealed, presumably at trial. It all indicates, of course, that Jack Smith continues to prosecute this case actively, aggressively, and indeed that the defense continues to defend against it equally actively and aggressively. There are some highlights that we know from those things that are not redacted in this huge compendium of documents. Like, for example, the actual documents that were signed by the conspirators in the fake electors scheme. All those documents from the various states, including right here in Wisconsin, the documents executed by the fake electors representing directly or indirectly that they are the actual electors, signaling that they are electing, if you will, from the various states, Donald Trump, when in fact Joe Biden won the election here in Wisconsin and in other places around the country. Those actual documents signed by them, the fake elector documents, those are a part of this huge compendium of documents released just this past week. They also include, in a fourth volume, a closer look at some of the activities undertaken by Donald Trump and John Eastman. You may recall he was one of the authors of this completely unfounded and ultimately criminal conduct, proposing that the election should be overturned, the results of your voting here in Wisconsin and around the country should be overturned. John Eastman also losing his license to practice law in California, other places around the country, also a defendant in some of these criminal cases for doing what he has done in violation of the law. Now disbarred lawyer John Eastman, who first came up with this crazy idea that the former president, that time the president of the United States of America, had a legitimate, lawful way, a means under the law to not only contest but overturn the results of this election. We know that that wasn't true, and he has paid the price for that. John Eastman has. Donald Trump also now, of course, charged both in the federal system and there in Georgia with pursuing that scheme, beginning with a thing called the Wisconsin Memorandum, and also pursued by others on behalf of the President of the United States of America. There is a description in these materials of the specific plan to steal the election It was cooked up by someone whose name is redacted, but who presented it plainly to the former president, and the response plainly by him to that plan, crazy and as unfounded and as illegal as it was enthusiasm, also reflected in those materials. In Volume 5, there's a memo that's marked personal and confidential that is indicative of a White House that's so deep into its own belief about this that it will do almost anything to try to undermine the Constitution. And it reads in part, this memorandum, in bold type, identified in the document, again, in bold form, as it says this: but this election, again, this is written internal to the White House, this election, the 2020 election, was stolen, it says, by a strategic Democrat plan to systemically flout existing election laws for partisan advantage. And we're no longer playing by those rules. And it goes on to say the main thing here, the main advocacy here, is that Vice President Pence, and again, this is when he is still in office, before all of these events become public, this memorandum, a part of the discussion inside the department of the White House. The main thing here is that Vice President Pence should exercise his 12th Amendment authority without asking for permission, either from a vote of the joint session or from the court. The joint session being, of course, the Congress, or from the court, capital C, the United States Supreme Court. Goes on to say this: let the other side, the people who won this election, the people who are on the side of justice and the rule of law, let them go into court. And there is a reference to some action by someone whose name is redacted, who in 2001 conceded that the president of the Senate might be in charge of counting the electoral votes, and others who would press a lawsuit, they would have their past position that those are non-judiciable political questions thrown back at them to get their lawsuit dismissed. All that legal language and strategic language to indicate that there's a method going forward here to challenge the election, and that we can do that in court. We can rely upon the institutions of government to try to overturn what the American public have said. It goes on to say then the fact is that the Constitution assigns this power to the vice president as the ultimate arbiter. And of course, that's also a part of the story that's in the indictment against Donald Trump. That's also a part of what we know coming out of that indictment and this long narrative. Now we've got some fleshing out of that in some of these documents, the 1800, 1900 treasure trove, if you will, of documents coming out of this case. The memorandum goes on to say this: if the illegality and fraud that has demonstrably occurred here is allowed to stand, they're talking about election fraud, which, of course, did not exist, does not exist in America. They're talking about something that's not real. And the Supreme Court has signaled unmistakably that it will not do anything about it. That's true. That's what the Supreme Court had said in some context. They're not going to get involved in this. The memorandum goes on to say, then the sovereign people no longer control the direction of the government, and we will have ceased to be a self-governing people. The stakes could not be higher. That's a memorandum that's inside these materials released by Tanya Chutkan just this past week. We are certainly going to hear more about that memorandum when the trial goes ahead, presumably sometime next year, maybe even beyond that, depending upon how long all of this takes to resolve. A significant result coming out of this decision by Tanya Chutkan, in the interest of justice, she says that it would be election interference not to release this right now, contrary to what the Trump folks are saying about just the opposite. And so that leads necessarily to the question of what's in front of Judge Chutkan going forward. Well, we know that she is affording the defense, Donald Trump, as is right to do, an opportunity to respond to all of this. And she has given him also a broad, broad time period in which to do it. His filing deadline is sometime after Thanksgiving. He also gets a larger page limit to present to her exactly what they think she should be doing. She's given all of that latitude to the defense, just as she gave it to the prosecution. Equal justice here, balanced administration of justice. And so presumably when they file their brief sometime after Thanksgiving, we'll get access to some of that and see what the defense says. Presumably their statement is going to be very simple. It's going to be that the case should be dismissed. That's the position they have taken up to now. But again, giving the defense, as is the normal course of conduct, an opportunity to be heard on this issue. That's what this is all about. And what will Judge Chutkan do? Well, she knows that she's got in front of her what she has already called a uniquely challenging task. No kidding. No kidding at all. I have sometimes referred to her as one of the brightest and best and most competent judges on the bench, also one of the most beleaguered judges on the bench, and she has before her a major task. She was going to be going line by line through this evidence presented by Jack Smith, presumably also taking into account exactly what the defense presents to her in late November. She'll consider this into December, probably issue an order sometime in the new year, in 2025, maybe a little bit sooner than that, depending upon how quickly she moves forward. But her job, again, is to determine which of these myriad, many specific allegations about Donald Trump's actions, what about those allegations can indeed survive the Supreme Court's recent ruling granting presidents this amazing broad form of immunity from criminal prosecution for most of their official actions. So what is her plan here? How does she begin to undertake this after she has heard from them? Maybe again orally. Maybe she's going to have another hearing on this kind of thing. She can have oral argument on this as well, not just for appellate courts. She could call the attorneys in and say, I'd like to hear from you again. I'd like to have you answer some of my questions that I see I've gathered from the documents you have submitted. She could do that as well. And so what happens? How does she go about this? Well, we know once again that according to the Supreme Court, if Donald Trump undertook a specific action in his private capacity, which of course is exactly what Jack Smith says he did, as a candidate for office rather than in his role as president of the United States of America, that act is deemed unofficial, according to the Supreme Court ruling. And those kinds of things are not subject to immunity. And so evidence about those can be cited in court, presented as evidence to support the charges against Donald Trump that he illegally tried to overturn the election. Again, if they are in his private personal capacity, and that is precisely what the prosecutor, the special counsel, has said in writing and orally all along the way. By contrast, again, giving more leeway, if you will, to the defense, the Supreme Court also provided some information about what are called the perimeter of presidential duties. In particular, if the actions of the president, of Donald Trump, fall within what the Supreme Court has referred to as the outer perimeter, the outer perimeter of presidential duties, it counts as official. And in that case, it is entitled to, at a minimum, presumptive immunity. That is, the executive entitled to presumptive immunity, a presumption that immunity would apply. And the court has to perform some additional analysis. This is what Tanya Chutkan will then have to do to determine whether it is off limits for any trial that she may schedule on matters like Donald Trump's attempt to strong arm those state officials. We know all about Georgia and the Secretary of State there into changing election results. And public lies, if the election was stolen, all those kinds of things still in this indictment. Prosecutors and defense attorneys are plainly going to spar viciously about this and disagree about whether Donald Trump was acting as a candidate in his private capacity, his personal capacity, just to maintain the office, to maintain power, or as a president who is constitutionally charged, statutorily charged, with overseeing the enforcement of federal election laws. That's what the defense is almost certainly going to maintain as they go forward. Under the Supreme Court's new doctrine, official actions by Donald Trump would fall then into two categories. Some of those are core to the president's exercise of his, one day her, executive power, in which case they're absolutely immune and no information about them can be used in the prosecution. That's the stunning statement made by the Supreme Court already. Other official acts are more peripheral, and they say they're more collateral, if you will, in which case prosecutors might still be able to use that information about them in court, depending upon the circumstances. One of the big caveats on all this, of course, already made reference to it in our broadcast this weekend, is respect to interactions with the Justice Department. All of those kinds of things, those core executive actions, are absolutely immune. Can't touch those at all. Can't do anything with them. They fall into that category of untouchable, no trial of those at all. As we continue with our discussion, a little bit more about the assignment in front of Tanya Chutkan, and then also taking callers here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This This is 93.5 The Tap.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Waba.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, talking about this Herculean task in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan now in the weeks and months ahead to figure out what she's going to do in the wake of this Supreme Court decision granting immunities, broad immunities to a president in the White House for criminal acts. Talking about the decision trees, if you will, that she's got to go through to figure out what is left to try. Jack Smith maintaining that everything, with the exception of the engagements with the Department of Justice, everything in the new indictment that you can try, he says, presumably the defense is going to come back and say, no, there's nothing at all. And as a part of that, she's going to have to wrestle again, not only with this notion of absolute immunities that affect connections with, communications with, conversations with an attorney general, those absolutely immune from prosecution, no longer a part of the indictment, but also other things the Supreme Court has said about this bifurcation of official and unofficial acts. Supreme Court saying that a president's peripheral official acts are presumptively immune, a lot to unpack there as well, depending upon the circumstances, exceptions, which plainly Jack Smith will embrace and advance, can be made that would allow that information to be a part of the prosecution of the president. The test, according to the Supreme Court in this incredible decision, is whether prosecuting a former president for that kind of an action would pose a danger of intruding on the authority and the functions of the executive branch. Well, I'd offer, as I have before, that virtually any kind of prosecution, any kind of litigation, criminal, civil, poses burdens, right, upon the people who are involved in that, a virtually impossible standard to address, but therefore finding if indeed there is a burden of intruding upon the presidency or the executive prerogative, it can't go ahead, even with those presumptive immunities. A chilling future president would no longer robustly carry out his or her responsibilities. That's what the Supreme Court has said, as it articulates once again this very muscular, this very active, this very nimble, this very fast-acting executive branch. That's not a part of our Constitution. Instead, our Constitution provides a strong executive branch, but one that's checked and balanced by other branches of government. The Supreme Court has said again in this task given to Tanya Chutkan, soon to be on her desk for decision, is that Donald Trump's pressuring of then Vice President Mike Pence in his capacity as the Senate president, that's constitutional, right, to block the congressional certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory was an official act. That was official, but that it might fall into this exception. It might fall into this new carved out exception the Supreme Court has identified, since the Constitution, and here's the point that Jack Smith will make loudly as he already has, is that the Constitution assigns no task, no role to the president or the executive branch in those proceedings. President has no role in determining who his or her successor may be. Nonetheless, Supreme Court providing some insights, some decision trees, if you will, for Tanya Chutkan. She won't make any decisions on immunity until late this year at the earliest, probably after the receipt by her of a responsive memorandum from the defense, maybe a reply from Jack Smith as well, could entertain, as I said, some additional oral argument at all of this. And then she could ask the two sides to flesh out their arguments even more at a hearing, other briefs, those kinds of things. And whatever she does, presumably in early 2025, likely once again to be appealed. Where? To the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, going up once again, as did the immunity decision in the early months of this year, maybe heading back once again to the Supreme Court to determine whether or not what Tanya Chutkan will do in the months just ahead, whether that was consistent with what they told her to do and this immunity decision issued on July 1. It is a lot. It is a lot. And it underscores once again the notion that there's no time in the immediate future when this case will go to trial. Wonder out loud, again, under a regime where we have in America practiced under this for a long period of time, a speedy trial act. Not in this case. Not in this case. Lots and lots of review. Appropriate to underscore, as always, that Donald Trump is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and that, yes, indeed, he's got this right, this absolute right to defend himself as aggressively and as effectively as his counsel may pursue. But at the same time, all of this delaying, plainly long beyond the election itself, what may happen in this case pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. She's got a lot on her desk right now and in the future. Be a fascinating story in early 2025 to see what she does, whether she buys into Jack Smith's view or buys into some portion of the defense view. Unlikely she's going to dismiss this case entirely, but could in fact winnow and sift through all of this and make some interim determinations, some kind of in the middle determinations about what can and cannot be tried, and maybe then schedule a trial date as she did in early 2024. Remember, this case was scheduled to go to trial in March of this year. Plainly, that did not happen. What did happen, of course, is that we've got callers here on Amicus Law Review. Delighted this weekend to have Joe with us. Joe, appreciate your comment, your question, as we go forward with this discussion this weekend.
Thanks very much. Great discussion. And I just wanted to ask of you if you could possibly do some research and look into this, because I don't want to dump it on you right now. just a short history and then my question. I saw a screening of a documentary called Vigilantes this last week. It was put together, produced by Greg Palast. It's P-A-L-A-S-T, a long time, a great reporter, worked for BBC, Washington Post, lawyer background, very, very smart guy, who has, for the last 25 years, without really intending it, his beat has become voter suppression, starting with the Florida election. So sure, he knows a lot about it and has really pushed on.
A good piece. You recommend it highly, Joe, I take it. Yes?
Vigilantes. You can go to his website, Greg Palast, PALAST.com, and watch it for free. And he wants everybody to send it out so this information gets out. But in the discussion, he mentioned, and it has to do with the 12th Amendment, and I, like most Americans, am not that knowledgeable about it, and that's why I don't want to dump this on you for discussion. But his point of view was that as we approach this next election, January 6th is not going to happen again. And instead, he said that Trump is planning on not winning the election, but winning the muckery afterwards.
Yes, yeah.
And what the date to look at would be December 11th. And apparently that is the date designated by the Constitution as what is called Certificate of Ascertainment deadline. Never heard of it, but the Certificate of Ascertainment deadline, as I understand it, is the day that every governor has to send to the National Archives the final list of electors to the Electoral College after their state has certified these votes. And his point is that if that certification from a state never arrives, that state gives away its electoral votes. You look at that and you think, what idiot state would ever give away their electoral votes? Well, if it's part of a plan, so if you don't get to the 270 electoral votes, then the election gets tossed into, as I understand it, the 12th Amendment process. And as he described that, under the 12th Amendment, all of the Electoral College votes are tossed out, and the president is chosen by each one of the states.
All sorts of great, dramatic things right there. Joe, we're going to go to our top of the hour break right now. But again, great assignment. We'll talk more about that amendment and the kinds of things that could happen. Appreciate so much your call this morning, and you're raising this issue for us to discuss, even the wake of November 5th, what could happen after that. And we're going to talk more about that and other issues.
93.5 The Tap. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Travel Wisconsin's Logan Rogie, who joins the show to discuss fall hotspots in our beautiful state. And we'll go back to the future with a discussion about Back to the Future.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
when it comes to accurate, reliable election information for Wisconsin voters, visit the official site. It's myvote.wy.gov. It's the big cheese, you could say. It's your one-stop source for official Wisconsin election information. Find your polling place, see your sample ballot, make sure your registration is up to date, and more at myvote.wy.gov. Sponsored by Wisconsin Elections Commission, aired by Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Nightlight.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. The race for the White House is tight.